Welcome to Spirits Podcast, a boozy dive into mythology, legends, and folklore. Every week we pour a drink and learn about a new story from around the world. I'm Amanda.
And I'm Julia.
And this is episode 128, Cannibalism and True Crime with Chelsea G. Summers.
So editor Eric was going through this episode and sent us a message saying that this is probably the chillest episode of Spirits he's ever listened to, which is saying something given our subject matter for this episode.
Yeah, I mean, basically, we just noticed that Chelsea had written a modern novel about a woman cannibal and was like, that sounds really interesting. And that she talks often about like feminism and aging and just all kinds of really fascinating topics. So we wanted to interview her. So in a way, this is not a traditional episode of Spirits because this is not like an exhaustive, survey of like the history and mythos and like cultural baggage of cannibalism, but more like one person's understanding of these topics, her involvement and, conflicted feelings about true crime, and really just like a kind of free ranging conversation about being a woman in a world where crime is like a genre and a fact. And it's really fascinating.
Yeah. And that's not to say that we don't talk about mythology in this episode. We do touch upon it in several points because cannibalism is extremely tied to mythology and in particular stories about women in mythology. So I'm curious to see what y'all think of this episode. I'm really excited about it.
Me too. I'm also so excited to have some new patrons with us. Welcome to Morgan, Francisco, Abby, L. Cincinnatus, Abigail, Jacob, Flem, Isabel, and Led Zeppelin.
I like Led Zeppelin. It's a very good name.
That's extremely good. And also extremely good, our supporting producer level patrons, Philip, Eeyore, Mercedes, Christopher, Kathy, Vinny, Danica, Marissa, Sammy, Josie, Neil, Jessica, and Phil Fresh.
Yeah, and I would share a bottle of wine, like the beautiful bottle of Smith & Hook Cabernet Sauvignon we had with this episode, with our legend level patrons, Haley, James, Jess, Sarah, Sandra, Audra, Jack Marie, and Leanne.
Speaking of wine, Julia, it is spring and summer, and I am getting much, much more into rosé than I am during the rest of the year, which is still pretty considerable. So I would love for you to recommend to me something to read or watch or listen to as I'm opening my next bottle.
Oh, Amanda, do I have a show for you? I just binged it this weekend. It is very good. It is new on Netflix. It is called Dead to Me. It is a dark comedy starring one Christina Applegate.
Ooh.
And Linda Cardellini.
The Cardelline!
And it's about two women who meet at a grief counseling group.
Group therapy, which I also love.
It is wild. There are twists and turns I never saw coming. The first episode is so action-packed and emotional and beautiful. Highly recommend it. It is a really, really good show. And something that it's those sweet half-hour episodes, too. So you can just binge through the whole thing.
A tight 30. I love it.
I know you do.
Beautiful. Well, I am going to have to check that out. And finally, before we get into the episode, we wanted to remind everybody that we have some live events coming up in New York City and Boston. We're also going to be at Pod X in Nashville and Podcast Movement in Orlando this August. So go on over to multitude.productions/live to get your tickets.
Yeah, and thank you again to our patrons in particular. Their support helps us go to things like this and host live shows and go to cons and have a great time where we can all enjoy the community that we're a part of.
It really means the world to us. And if you're able to give even a couple bucks per episode, we really, really appreciate your support. That's at patreon.com/spiritspodcast. And now enjoy Spirits Podcast episode 128, Cannibalism and True Crime with Chelsea G. Summers. We are here with Chelsea G. Summers, who is a writer and author now, who has a novel that's published this summer or fall. When does it come out?
It comes out some point this fall. Is it going to be an Audible exclusive?
Well, we love Audible here.
It's an audiobook.
That is very, very exciting. Oof. And would you tell our audience what it's about?
Sure. It's called A Certain Hunger, and it is a memoir-style novel about a woman who is a cannibalistic serial killer food critic who kills and eats her ex-lovers.
Oh, so many words that you just said I'm so in love with.
Listeners, you can understand why we heard about your book on Twitter and we were like, excuse me, would you please come on the show?
Thanks so much. So the elevator pitch is it's Eat, Pray, Love meets American Psycho.
Oh my God.
Amazing. And maybe I would love to hear about the cannibalism that you researched and wrote about and the kind of intersection between that and like personal storytelling. But first, can I say, like, I thought I was the only person who really loved sort of spiritual memoirs and also true crime. So is that something that really interests you? Like, how do these two things interact in your own life?
I am very much into true crime. I've written a couple pieces about it. One was for Medium's Truth issue. And I listen to a bunch of podcasts and I read a ton of books and I will indulge in the occasional Snapped marathon. Yeah, I really dig true crime, particularly if it's based around women criminals. I think it's an important cultural interest to look at how we portray, talk about, think about, adjudicate, and sensationalize women criminals in a very specific way. So a lot of my interest is feminist, and then the rest of it is just kind of, you know, your basic thriller. Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's been on my mind a lot recently with the Theranos documentaries and stories that have been out in the news.
Yeah.
I really loved the book, which was on, you know, have the company
Bad Blood.
Sort of got, yeah, Bad Blood. It was, oh my gosh, so good.
Yeah.
I love those sort of like corporate thrillers.
Right.
But a lot of that story had to do with like getting institutional endorsement. And a lot of that had to do with like older, wealthy, powerful men really being like entranced by a younger woman.
Yeah.
And a lot of the discourse around it, you know, people don't always quite articulate, but I think the assumption is sort of like, oh, well, she bewitched them or she, you know, like seduced them.
Right.
Not literally, but, you know, with like her just, I don't know,
her
manner.
Unblinking stare and fake baritone.
I know. But it's like, it's so strange how like her body and appearance and candor, like there's always huge images of her with any story about her, Elizabeth Holmes, the CEO. So I just think it's fascinating and not a thing that we have sort of the vocabulary to talk about in a really nuanced way.
Yeah, I also think that you bring up a good point, which is that true crime is exploding. It used to be just all murder and, you know, dismemberment, kidnapping, etc. And now there's a real swing to, okay, there's also corporate true crime and there's political true crime and there are these wider sort of resonating criminal acts that we're beginning to understand in very different ways than we did, you know, 10 years ago. I think in part because of who's writing about it, but also because of who's doing it.
Mm-hmm. For sure. So tell us more about the plot of the book. How did you, or not the plot, but like the sort of concerns and research that you did, the stuff that interests you to lead you to write this story?
Yeah, so I was, it started in 2011. I had spent the spring of 2011 in Italy, in a really small town on the Italian Riviera. And
did you kill a man in a rowboat?
I didn't, but I did fall in love with a really stupid, cruel Italian, as one is wont to do. And we broke up right as I was leaving, and I was really heartbroken, and I felt really lonely the entire time I'd been there. It was kind of like living in The Shining with palm trees. And I decided I wanted to return on my own terms. So I was going back that fall. A friend of mine was like, oh yeah, you can do something like Eat, Pray, Love. She's like, only, you know, flip it. I was like, sure, the first, you know, woman zombie story. And then, you know, Pray, Love, Eat. and then I was like, well, actually, that's kind of interesting, because I was really still very angry at this man. So I went back and I was staying in the 17th century Tuscan villa by myself, and I wrote the first scene of the novel, and then it kind of hung out for a while in my head, and it took me about 6 years to finish it after that. And a lot of it was processing my own feelings and experiences about being middle-aged, about feeling frustrated with the publishing industry, about the ways that we consume things, the kind of reasons why we consume the things that we do, and getting past a lot of the like negative feelings I had about relationships. Yeah. So I wrote the book And then it took a couple of, it took about a year before I found representation. And then it took about 18 months before my editor, Jen Adden, sold it. So it's going to be an Audible exclusive, and we're hoping to sell the paper rights, fingers crossed.
Very, very cool. Thanks. So I'm slightly curious because cannibalism is such a very specific genre, I suppose, or a very specific tradition or taboo. So what about cannibalism?
Yeah, the thing that's really fascinating to me about cannibalism is that it's historically wrapped up in a lot of lies that we tell ourselves. There's a really wonderful scientist at the American Museum of Natural History, Bill Shutt, who wrote a book called Cannibalism, A Thoroughly Natural History.
Yes.
And one of the things that he does in the book is debunk this idea that specifically white Europeans never, like, left cannibalism in the dust centuries ago. The fact is that they didn't, and neither did Americans. And white Europeans set up this sort of mythology. In fact, the word cannibal comes from the word that Christopher Columbus and all of the other Spanish dudes who were sailing to the quote unquote New World called the people here in the New World in order to dissuade other people from taking the trip across the ocean and doing more quote unquote discovery. So it was very much an idea of other people are always cannibals. We are never cannibals ourselves. But the truth is that medical cannibalism was practiced throughout Europe well into the Victorian age.
Yeah.
And what is medical cannibalism?
Medical cannibalism was the belief that you could heal yourself through generally slathering on parts of other human bodies. Like, a lot of human fat was used in cosmetics or in medicines, but also if you ate or swallowed executed man's blood or ground up mummies or other kinds of parts of human bodies, it would help you heal yourself.
I'm so glad you brought up the powdered mummy eating, because it's one of my favorite things.
Powdered mummy eating is awesome.
It's very, very cool, but also the reason why we don't have as many mummies, because we kept wanting to eat them.
Sure.
Yeah, the context, not so cool.
Well, yes.
But the idea is kind of wild, and it hasn't left us. Like last week I read a headline about some like venture capitalist who wants to inject himself with like young people's blood.
Oh, Peter Thiel, that's a thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wasn't going to name him, try to evoke him in the mirror, Beetlejuice style, but yeah.
We don't boogeyman Peter Thiel here on this podcast. If we say it one more time.
Yeah, well, I mean, the interesting thing is that cannibalism is such a lingering and spidering myth. So, or not even just myth, like it's a reality. That it shows up in so many different guises. So whether it's something like, you know, zombies eating other humans, or Dracula drinking people's blood, or people actually killing and eating other people, or survival cannibalism, or, you know, exocannibalism where you're eating your enemies, or endocannibalism where you're eating your own in order to commemorate them. Like, there are many, many different faces, both literal and mythic. And so I got really interested in it because I come to writing as a former academic. I was a PhD candidate in 18th century British literature.
Oh, fantastic.
So I'm really interested in the ways that we use words, the ways that literary tropes shape our thinking, the ways that we tell stories in order to understand things about ourselves. Cannibalism was always fascinating because the idea of, like, you know, you hold up a baby and you're like, oh my God, you're so cute, I could just eat you up, you know, and that's a thoroughly acceptable thing to say. And literally, it's really gross.
That is true.
There's something, yeah, about that just instinct. I don't know. As I'm thinking now, I wonder why we decided that this was like the line, and by we, I mean kind of like the, you know, Western dominant narrative, that like this is a line that we don't cross. Right. And it makes total sense. It's something I didn't know until now, that those origins are intended to like malign someone. Like it's a reaction against a behavior you find, not a like moral thing that you put on yourself, like a, you know, a mantle you take on.
Right. Well, there's a, you know, I mean, you know, whether it's like the Wendigo myth, which is, you know, the Native American idea that there's a psychosis that causes you to eat people, or want to eat people, or whether it's like Maenads who would, you know, who are handmaidens of Dionysus, who would dance themselves and drink themselves into frenzy and then tear apart a man and eat him. Mm-hmm. There's one particular flavor of cannibalism is that it's always just on the other side of losing control.
Mm-hmm.
And right. that it's accessible and it's there for all of us. Cannibalism in some kind of way talks about these urges that we have and have to repress or learn to repress or, you know, not pay attention to, but they still burble up into our consciousness. And that's like why something like Hannibal is so satisfying.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are both big Hannibal fans.
Yeah, I loved Hannibal. I loved Hannibal and all of its shiny, wet surfaces.
So beautiful.
Yes.
Like there's, you know, the idea that here's this ultra refined, incredibly erudite, terribly well-dressed, extremely mannered, very controlled man who on the other side is creating these wonderful masterpieces of hideousness that draw people into his orbit, whereupon he can prey upon them. It very much ties into a kind of Freudian, you know, death wish, a Freudian consumption wish, a desire to both be eaten and to do the eating. It's a really bizarre inflection point in I think basic human psychology. And I love it.
I love it too. I'm just sitting here quietly, like with my eyes open, like, oh my goodness, I so agree. This is such a good conversation.
But yeah, so like I have this one shelf in my kitchen. My apartment's kind of small. So I have three, you know, floor to ceiling bookshelves that are around my dining room, my kitchen table, and they butt up against the stove. And this past spring, I had to have the gas line in the apartment building was replaced. So they had to rip out my stove and replace this whole gas line. And sort of like at the eye level of the plumbers who were doing the replacing is this one bookshelf that goes from serial killer to cannibal books, to cookbooks, all aligned on the same shelf because
that's so beautiful.
I have a perverse sense of humor.
Oh, Chelsea, that's so good. Thank you for that.
I love that so much. Did you read Janice Poon's Hannibal cookbook?
I read her blog a lot. I didn't ever get her cookbook, but blogging, she's great.
And it really is such a fine line. Like they're, you know, at I guess this is part of the conversation, right? Of like liking crime and writing about crime is you don't want to glorify harming someone else, but kind of giving those urges and thoughts and behaviors space, I think, is ultimately a way to understand them and to have more, you know, like rigorous questioning, but also more empathy of the people around you. So did you kind of consider that or have that on your mind at all when deciding to write about behaviors like this?
I had on my mind the importance to me as a woman and to others who consider themselves women, that it's important for women-identified people to read crime perpetrated by chicks. That I really wanted to get in the head and in the voice and in the life of somebody who was a sociopath and whose life was more important than everybody else's, and to get a sense of like what it meant, not on a thin and superficial level, but more on a textured, layered, lived as much as I could as a novelist experience of how that would be. And in part because I wanted to consider for myself, well, what would it feel like to be doing these kinds of things? What would it feel like to have these particular bunches of problems to solve? What would it be like to live with the aftermath? What would it be like to have the police come after you? What would it be like to have friendships throughout all of these mm-hmm. various acts? How do all of these things come together in the life of this one particular, you know, woman who's also given a lot of the gifts of like Hannibal? She's multilingual. She's really smart. She's completely nuts. You know, like I also really wanted to see a woman who has these sort of super, almost, you know, like super extraordinary gifts, just as we see somebody like Hannibal have. So like as a writer, I could create her. And mm-hmm. so I did.
That's amazing. And there must be something too. I actually wonder if this has changed the way that you like experience daily life, and if there's like a level of fear that's less than it was before, because there's something so radical about like imagining yourself as someone who has like grown up as a woman in the world, you know, mostly fearful of the harm that could be inflicted upon you by others, and to sort of consider for a moment, you know, not having that mindset.
I'm sort of odd in that like, I'm not saying I've never clutched my keys between my fingers or, mm-hmm. you know, thought about the fact that I can't really run in the dress I'm wearing and the shoes that are on my feet. But I am saying that I don't really walk around the world in a state of being afraid. And maybe that's my age. Like, I'm in my mid-50s. So I didn't grow up in a time when kids were on milk cartons when I was sitting mm-hmm. down for my morning cereal. Mm-hmm. You know, like the kind of anxiety that millennials were raised with, I didn't have. So that may be different. It may just be me. I mean, I've been living in New York since 1989. I don't know. I don't really walk around afraid that much.
Nor should you.
Yeah. Nobody, really, nobody should. But I do think that what writing the book has done for me, oddly, is made me a lot more aware of like carceral justice and the jurisprudence system and what happens when people go to prison and what that means mm-hmm. and how that kind of like I just sort of walked around the world, you know, and part of it is just kind of what's happened in the last 5 years with Black Lives Matter and our current presidency and various other, but it really did raise a much bigger awareness of like, all right, well, what does it, you know, like, what does it mean to go to jail?
No, I think that's an excellent point. And it's something that you're writing.
I've also become a better cook.
Fantastic. I like that a lot.
Now, Julia, we're coming up on the middle of May. And there's lots of things to know about early May. Like there's like May the 4th be with you. There's like a bunch of fun birthdays, including friend of the show, Eric Silver. But for me, May 15th is really important because it's the middle of Q2. Oh. And as you run a business, lots of stuff has to happen on a quarterly basis, including like looking at your finances and invoicing clients and doing all of what I find to be pretty satisfying once it's done, but a little bit boring to get through, all those kinds of tasks that just need to happen in the running of a business. Mm-hmm. And I'm very happy that I have HoneyBook on my side. This is a purpose-built business management tool that lets me control client communication, bookings, contracts, invoices, all in one spot. Whether you're a freelancer or a small business owner, HoneyBook helps you stay organized with custom templates and automation tools, which is huge for saving time. You can connect it to stuff like QuickBooks, the Google Suite, and MailChimp, all of which we use here at Multitude to run our biz. And there are over 75,000 happy clients that have saved between hundreds and thousands of hours a year using HoneyBook's tools. Right now, HoneyBook is offering our listeners half off your first year with the promo code SPIRITS.
The best part about that is payment is flexible. So the promotion applies to whether you pay monthly or if you pay annually. And so you can go to honeybook.com and use the promo code SPIRITS for 50% off your first year. So you can get paid faster, work smarter with honeybook.com, promo code SPIRITS. Amanda, how often do you think about your socks?
Only unless there's a problem, usually.
Yeah, usually, right? Like if I'm going out in somewhat heels and I need to wear socks with those, I have to think about, okay, well, which of these socks has the most like comfy bottoms there. So once I'm walking around like 20 blocks in heels, I'm not completely sore by the end of it.
Or like, oh, wow, that feels like a weird pain on my toe. And then you look down and oop, nope, the sock has a hole in it. And Now I have a blister.
Yep. Oof, the absolute worst. You know what hasn't been the worst, though? My feet.
Is it Bombas?
My feet since I got Bombas.
Yeah.
So Bombas is changing the way you think about socks, and they are the most comfortable socks in the history of feet. I love that line, but it's true. So they are made of super soft, natural cotton, and every pair comes with arch support, seamless toe, cushioned footbed, so it's comfy but not too thick. That cushioned footbed is so important.
And being made of all cotton, it really is amazing how much more breathable cotton is versus all the like sweat wicking, like spandex related stuff that I thought was better, but it's really not.
Sometimes you have to wear shoes in the summer that make you wear socks, and Bombas makes them comfortable and also breathable. And that's so important to my poor, poor feet. The beautiful part too is they come in colors, patterns, lengths, styles, all different kinds. And they look great if you're wearing them to the gym, to the office, around town. So Bombas is what feet daydream about.
Oh, cute.
So you can buy your Bombas at bombas.com/spirits today. That's B-O-M-B-A-S. And you can get 20% off your first purchase. Again, that is bombas.com/spirits for 20% off.
And for every Bombas purchase you make, they donate a pair of socks to someone in need, which
that's
is
so nice.
Awesome. That's bombas.com/spirits.
Amanda, tell me about learning.
I will tell you about learning, Julia, especially featuring a bunch of badass women who tell incredible stories and teach me incredible things. Because this week, we are sponsored by Skillshare. And I want to recommend to you the course Powerful Storytelling Today, Strategies for Crafting Great Content with Soledad O'Brien, the journalist. I heard her on Anne Friedman's podcast Going Through It recently, and she has had the wildest career of anyone I've ever heard. She was often the first woman and or the first Black person or Black woman in her newsrooms that she's worked in, and just had to like tear down so many doors and put so many people like very kindly in their place, or else she would have been fired. It's like, it's really amazing to hear her journey. But in this course, she tells you all about journalism, about storytelling. It's not just for journalists, but I really did appreciate that kind of like interview and fact-finding lens. Really, really good.
Soledad O'Brien is one of my idols, and I really, really would want to take this class.
It is extremely good. And Julia, you know that you can get 2 free months of Skillshare Premium, so you can take this course and the 25,000 plus other classes that Skillshare has to offer by going to skillshare.com/spirits2.
Yeah, Skillshare has been such a great supporter of the show, and they are wonderful, and we love their classes, including Amanda's class. You could still take it. Go do it. Podcast marketing.
Thanks.
So again, that is skillshare.com/spirits2 to get 2 months of Skillshare Premium for free.
Join this online learning community for creators. They really are the bomb. That's skillshare.com/spirits2. And now let's get back to the show.
I would love to ask you, because you talked about looking at cannibalism through the lens of feminism. And one of the like most obvious examples, at least in my book, is looking at the cannibalistic witch in fairy tales from all over, specifically like Baba Yaga, the Hansel and Gretel story, anything like that. And I would love to hear your thoughts on kind of that as almost like a prototype to what we see cannibalism in Western society now.
Yeah, so I've gotten really interested in witches, and I think my next project is you know, my next book project is going to have something to do with witches. I'm not really sure what yet.
Well, we can't wait to listen slash hear that. We're pro witch.
Yeah. But, you know, I mentioned a little earlier Maenads, and I wrote a short story about a friend of mine was doing she was running a reading, and she asked me to write a story. So I did. And it's about a group of Maenads who rent an Airbnb, and one of them brings in a guy, and they get him drunk and dismember him and eat him, as Maenads are wont to do. I think that there's a thing specifically about women consuming children and men that speaks to fears about what happens if women don't toe the lines that they're supposed to be towing in culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, there's a ton of myths, you know, like Cronos eating his children, and like that whole family of Greek myths, the Cronos family. There's like five different stories of cannibalism. Mostly it's women baking sons into pies, feeding it to their husbands, or men eating their brothers or kids. And nobody really talks about that. Like, it's sort of like, oh yeah, men eat men, whatever, whatever. But what's really scary is if, you know, a woman were to do that.
Well, it's the opposite of procreation, right?
Right.
Which is like the one, you know, societally acceptable role in patriarchy.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. But there's also this idea that, like, just sort of lurking, you know, somewhere under the thin socialized surface is the ability to break all boundaries and, you know, bring out the rosemary and sage.
Yeah, right.
I like that. I like the idea that women could break these bonds at any time and just start fucking shit up.
Right.
I know, just asking what if is powerful. You know, like, your rebellion doesn't necessarily have to look like that in order for that thought, and just putting that, like, seed of thought into you. Like, oh, wow, I can act differently. Like, I can be different to what's expected of me. I can say no, and I can, you know, be disobedient. Like, that's huge.
Yeah, I mean, like, so, you know, I got married about a year and a half ago, and I love my husband a lot, and he's awesome. But every once in a while, when we're in the kitchen together, I just sort of think about turning around and plunging the knife into him. And it's not that I want to do it. It's not that I'm going to do it, right? But I spoke to, so I you know, like, I don't have a whole lot of friends who are married, and I had a friend and I were out for drinks. I was like, so do you, this, and this friend happened to be a guy. I was like, so do you ever think about, you know, when you're in the kitchen with Amanda, just like, you know, shoving the knife into her? He goes, oh yeah, totally. Like, so I think that there's also this thing where, like, we as humans have this violence underneath us that is not necessarily, it's not something that we pay attention to, but it is something that articulates its voice every now and again. And those myths, you know, the myths of obviously the myth of Hansel and Gretel is to teach little kids, you know, don't go wandering in the woods, don't take candy from strangers, you know, but it's also like teaching women, like, that thing, that violence you want, you think about, that violence you contemplate is there. It's not good. Don't give in to it.
Yeah.
And the flip side of every crime story is, like, the overwhelming theory about why women watch true crime or read true crime, and I'm speaking not about, like, Bad Blood, but, you know, specifically violent crime, is that it allows us to feel prepared. That, you know, like, if you listen to, And I don't particularly, my favorite murder, you know, like, stay sexy, don't get murdered, like, don't get into the trunk. Like, it's always these sort of,
right,
you know, toss off pieces of advice. The idea being that you can arm yourself. You're, you know, forewarned is forearmed. I also think that the other reason why it's appealing to us is that it allows us to safely experience the violent feelings of the criminal involved. And that's actually true with, you know, somebody like Elizabeth Holmes, that watching The Inventor or reading Bad Blood, or I can't remember what the podcast was that featured.
The Dropout.
Yeah. What if I were Elizabeth Holmes? What if I did, you know, believe in myself?
Ask for what I want and get it. Yeah.
Yeah. Believe in myself with that like cast iron, titanium clad sense of entitlement. What would that feel like to me? How would I walk around the world? Would I be wearing black turtlenecks? I don't know. But, you know, like what would that feel like if that particular door were open to me? So the, like, whether it's cannibalism or whether it's, you know, siphoning off, you know, millions and millions of dollars from various investors, there's a sense of indulging in these stories of criminals because something about that brazenness, something about that unshakability, something about that wantonness, something about that bloodlust is available to us.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you wrote a whole book about these thoughts and impulses because I definitely want to read it.
Thank you.
It reminds me a little bit of the sort of like feeling you get when you look over a cliff or a bridge, you know, or if you're like driving fast on the highway, like there is this, I think there's like an actual name for it, but this like death drive or this just thought, like, what if I did it? And, like, especially in discussions of like mental health or suicidal ideation, like it's so, I thought actually I brought to my therapist when I first was going to take a treatment for depression and anxiety, like surely I am a monster for having these thoughts. Like surely I am dangerous to myself and to others for occasionally thinking like, you know, that is an option that is available to me in my body. You know, when like faced with a situation like that. And in fact, it's like super normal and a ton of people experience it.
Sure.
But I think too, that there is something, there's something really like calming and a lot of agency in saying it's a thing I can do and I won't. And just kind of affirming to yourself, I don't know, like kind of testing, not even testing a boundary, but like identifying the boundary or believing in yourself, like, hey, it would be easy or it would be thrilling or it would be something, but it's not a thing I'm going to do.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like every time I walk past any body of water with my cell phone in my hand, I imagine just hurling it out and hearing that really satisfying thunk as it hit the water.
You know, I imagine pushing vases off of pedestals in museums. Like, I don't want to. I'm not going to. But it's so tempting.
Yeah, it's like if you're in a restaurant and servers go by with plates full of French fries, and I think of, or if you're walking past an outdoor cafe and somebody's sitting, you know, eating French fries, I always think about taking one off and just walking with, you know, and eat.
Oh, God, same.
And, yeah. And like, so I gave my protagonist the opportunity to do a couple of things like that because I've never done it.
Yeah, and it's just like an ownership over the world that that's something actually. Julie and I saw the American Psycho musical on Broadway.
Oh, did
and,
you?
Yeah, and it was actually a very interesting like piece of art. But I went after that to read the novel, and I was like, oh, like wait, this is. You know, I get why the moralistic panic is happening, but also it's just like such a foreign sense of not even like, I guess it is entitlement, but just an idea that like the whole world is mine for the taking that I do almost want to try on a little bit. Like I tell friends when they're going into job interviews, like just assume a like straight cis white male confidence, like imagine your most privileged and confident friend and like assume a little bit of that air when you need to, like it's a weapon you can deploy.
Right. It's like a suit. You know, like it's the idea of being able to put on the Hannibal suit, you know, and walk like Mads Mikkelsen.
Oh, my God. Mads Mikkelsen's truly style goals.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, like you know, a large part of me wanting to write this book was feeling like I'm middle aged. You know, my career had sort of hit a weird dead end. I didn't know what was going to be on the other side of, you know, like of middle age. Like I felt like I was spinning my wheels and I was really angry and really frustrated. And so I put a lot of those feelings of being really angry and really frustrated with my career, with relationships, with expectations into the book, you know, and also like, because it's about, she's a food writer and it's about cannibalism, you know, like I did a lot of deep dives into how and what we eat and how we kill animals and mm-hmm. what that mm-hmm. means and how do we think about consuming and what is ethical consumption and, you know, like how do you critique these things while still being a meat eater?
Yeah.
I think in particular, like one of the reasons why zombies have been so big in the last, you know, like seven, eight years is that we've reached a kind of crisis of consumption. Like Twitter, Facebook, Netflix, YouTube, Hulu, you know, Amazon, Google, it's just hot and cold running Tinder, you know, Grindr. It's hot and cold running consumption all the time, every day, if you want it. At a certain point, you know, you have to ask yourself, well, what am I eating? Like, what am I, you know, what am I consuming? And am I just consuming, you know, iterations of my own self?
Blowing my mind right now. Some serious introspection coming later for me.
Yeah, you know, and so the other reason why I wanted to or, you know, like I, as I was writing the book, I had no idea that what I was doing was writing a satire of various industries. I ended up doing that. But part of the book was like, well, you know, like what about consumption? Mm. What feeds hunger? You know, what satisfies hunger? And how is food a questionable item when it's something we need?
Especially for people raised female and, you know, body image, like body dysmorphia, eating disorders. Yeah. So much of what we, not just what we do, but what we take in and put out. Like as I get older, I am more and more astonished at the policing of pregnant people's bodies that happens. And it's just like accepted as like a standard because there is this moral panic over, you know, people that are producing other people. And like, we think that we have a just societal right over like policing what they do and eat and wear and look like. And it's just like, everything is related. And as just I get older, you know, speaking for myself, as I am sort of presented with opportunities to see how much I am socialized to like have certain opinions and see certain things as good or bad or virtuous or devilish or whatever it might be. Like it is staggering. And I'm sure that that is a project that will continue my entire life.
Yeah. It's a lot of unlearning.
Yeah. 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 I don't know. I mean, how do you think about the stuff that you write and watch and take in?
Yeah. One of the advantages of making my protagonist, a sociopath, is that she really doesn't care about, and like, you know, thin, fat, like she doesn't think of herself in those kinds of terms at all. She's tall. She knows she's advantaged. That's basically it. Mm-hmm. But there isn't a lot of discussion. Like she never describes herself. It's very, you know, she has red hair. That's basically it. Mm-hmm. And that she's tall.
That's so freeing for a female character. I can't think of like a single female character that isn't described in her like appearance and attractiveness.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, she's middle-aged but that's about the extent of it. Of course it's a memoir style. So you see her different ages, but, a lot of other people, I think about, well, how much time would I have if I had never spent time worrying about my weight or my shape? It's a hard, you know, like it's a hard trap. Like, you know, like what is it? What is being strong? What is being healthy? What is, you know, determining the aesthetics that you want for yourself because you want them for yourself? And what is being guided by media, dubious medical advice, you know, cultural baggage, patriarchy, misogyny, you know, the diet industry, goop, like, you know, what is, so it's an ongoing thing. And like, I think that one of the giant pluses of the last few years, and in specific, Twitter, but also publishing, is that there's been an opening up of voices for people who are not white, not cis, not, you know, who are non-gender binary, who are, who, you know, claim fat for themselves, who understand that and want to talk about a place and a style and a way of living that is counter to or questioning of dominant narratives. And a lot of that, like, I have some fat friends, and they write about being fat, and they talk about being fat, and they question what it means when, you know, people make assumptions about thinness or fatness. And it's like, it's really revelatory in terms of my opening my eyes and being like, oh yeah, I have been a complete fucking dumbass, you know, in terms of swallowing, unquestioning, like, these lines that culture has dictated to me. So yeah, I mean, I think that it is like a lifetime of like undoing, you know, and it never, and it only changes. Like, you know, as you get older, it's like, well, what does it mean to be a middle-aged woman? Does this mean I have to cut my hair? Does this mean I have to wear Eileen Fisher? Does this mean I can't wear leather pants?
It's presented to you on your 50th birthday.
Yeah, like, basically, here's your card. It comes with your AARP membership, you know?
Of course.
Like, it's really a very bizarre thing. And like, because I don't act or look that way, in some places, when I'm walking around, I get a lot of like, very strange looks. Like, my husband's Swedish. I spent half the year in Sweden. Outside of like Stockholm city center, and even some places in Stockholm, like, there aren't women with like bright red hair and tattoos who are in their 50s. Mm-hmm. Like, they just aren't. And it's very strange. Like, here, you know, like, walking around New York, I'm not that weird. You know, up in the middle of nowhere Sweden, I am a rare bird.
What has aging been like compared to what you expected, if you thought about it?
What's most unexpected is how I have grown more authentically me. Like, I'm more me than I've ever been before. And I really thought like I'd grow up and I'd be a very different person. And I'm like, no, I'm basically, you know, like, I'm just me. And that my experience of aging is kind of like, you know, those anatomy textbooks that have clear plastic overlays. And so you have like, right, you know, the skeleton, and then one system, and then another system, and then another system, and another system, all laid over. And you can peel each one back and see it separately, or you can see them working together. And that's sort of how I feel about aging. At any one particular time, I may be experiencing something as a 7-year-old, as a 23-year-old, as a 32-year-old, as a 45-year-old, and as a 56-year-old.
Wow. That's so like encouraging for me to hear. Not that you have to be like inspirational in your messaging all the time, but you know, it's you're not often like exposed to a lot of reasons why getting older is great. Apart from like being able to live on your own when you're an adult, you know, or like vote or drive or whatever it might be.
Right.
And that's something I've heard consistently, is just like caring less about what people think of you. And I feel sometimes like a total failure because I care so very much what other people think of me, and I want so very badly to be liked, that it just like, I'm glad to hear that for a lot of people that ends up getting better over time.
Yeah. I mean, any time I spent in my life caring about other people liking me, I was miserable.
Yeah.
And when I look back at those times, and they're for me, because I haven't really cared that much about that. They've been very specific and very limited. I look back at those times and I'm like, yeah, I was fucking miserable, man. That sucked. Like, You know, it's so much better to just go in on my own terms. It's funny. I was I guess it was last week on Twitter. I saw somebody like had tweeted something about, you know, I can't wait until I'm middle-aged. I'm going to wear crazy big hats and caftans and not give a fuck what anybody thinks. And I'm like, dude, what's stopping you?
Do it now.
Yeah.
Like, seriously, what's stopping you? You want to wear a crazy hat? Wear a fucking crazy hat. Like, you know, you don't know you're going to grow old.
That's true. Wow.
Totally. You know? I know we've gotten kind of far afield from cannibalism, but it is all related. Julia, do you have any questions that I sort of steamrolled over in my eagerness to talk about living as a woman in society?
I mean, I always want to hear you talk about living as a woman in society, so it's fine. All right, for you, Chelsea, are there any, I think we discussed them as flavors before, but are there any other flavors of cannibalism, which, God, I love that phrase, that you like
the
really, really love?
The puns just write themselves.
They just do.
They really
do. Are there
yeah,
any?
Yeah, my favorite form of cannibalism, other than neonatal cannibalism, where like sharks eat the other sharks or twins eat the other twin, is of course sexual cannibalism, because come on, that's just awesome. And actually, Bill Schutz's book gets a lot into various kinds of sexual cannibalism. But you know, we think of like praying mantises, but my book is very much about you know, there's once when she does it in flagrante delicto, and that's kind of cool, you know.
That is kind of cool. It reminds me of a lot of the Hannibal fandom.
If you don't speak Latin, you could probably figure out what that is.
It's really going to gross some people out a lot. I mean, I wrote the book and I was like, well, I really want to make people hungry, horny, and horrified. And I hope I've succeeded.
Wow, I love being all of those things. So
God, that's
perfect to me.
Thanks.
Please let the people know where they can find you online and how they can get your book.
Yeah. So Audible still doesn't have a release date, but it should be October. I'm Chelsea G. Summers on Twitter, and also chelseagsummers.com is my website. And then I have a tiny letter that you can subscribe to, which is tinyletter.com/ChelseaGSummers. So it's all branded. And yeah, we're hoping to, my agent and I are hoping to sell the paper rights to the novel. So if you're not into audiobooks, fingers crossed, in another year or so, it should be out in paper as well.
No, go ahead. Fabulous. Well, we'll promote the crap out of the book once it is on Audible. Just let us know. We'll tweet all about it.
Oh, thanks so much. I will.
Of course.
I want to eat the other Twitter users that have various permutations of my name so that I can get it. And now I'm going to lean into that instinct. So thank you so much for coming on the show and for getting so real with us. I appreciate it so much. And I feel like this is a conversation that I wish I had earlier, and I'm only 27, so I hope that a lot of our listeners find it similarly illuminating.
All right, lovely. My pleasure.
Absolutely. And remember, listeners, to stay creepy.
Stay cool. Thanks again to our sponsors. Get 50% off your first year of HoneyBook at honeybook.com with the promo code SPIRITS. You can get your Bombas socks at bombas.com, bombas.com/spirits for 20% off. And Skillshare is offering you 2 months absolutely free of Skillshare Premium at skillshare.com/spirits2. Spirits was created by Amanda McLaughlin, Julia Schaffini, and Eric Schneider, with music by Kevin McLeod and visual design by Allison Wakeman.
Keep up with all things creepy and cool by following us at Spirits Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. We also have all of our episode transcripts, guest appearances, and merch on our website, as well as a form to send us your urban legends at spiritspodcast.com.
Join our member community on Patreon, patreon.com/spiritspodcast, for all kinds of behind-the-scenes stuff. Just $1 gets you access to audio extras with so much more available too. Recipe cards, director's commentaries, exclusive merch, and real physical gifts.
We are a founding member of Multitude, a collective of independent audio professionals. If you like Spirits, you will love the other shows that live on our website at multitude.productions.
And above all else, if you liked what you heard today, please share us with your friends. That is the very best way to help us keep on growing.
Thank you so much for listening. Till next time.